I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Just as societies can improve a lot, they can erode, and I'm seeing that erosion.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Oliver Wiseman, CapEx's editor. My guest this week is Sir Paul Collier, Professor of Economics at the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. As a development economist, Paul has spent his life tackling some of the thorniest and most important questions around. What's holding the world's poorest back? And what can be done to give them a route out of that poverty? His best-selling book, The Bottom Billion, published a decade ago, quickly became a must-read for anyone remotely interested in the area. More recently, however, Paul's focus has changed. His latest book, The Future of Capitalism, deals with what he thinks has gone wrong not in a failed African state, but here, in the West, where he thinks our political and economic system just isn't living up to the promises we make about it. I started by asking him why he has shifted his attention to issues closer to home.
Well, partly because I'm pretty worried about what is happening. What's happening is new divisions, rifts in society, that when I was a kid weren't there. And as it happens, in my personal life, I sort of straddle these divides, and so I'm very conscious of them. I see both sides of these new divides, and they're vicious, and I want to do something about them. I think it also helps that having worked on societies which are really not functioning well at all, I've long realized that our own societies, which have worked very well, they've not worked very well because of some magic in the air. There are practical aspects of how the society is organized and the ideas in people's heads that make them function well. And so I can see those ideas eroding. So just as the struggle in poor countries is a struggle for change, both in ideas and in policies that are built on ideas, so just as societies can improve a lot, they can erode, and I'm seeing that erosion.
And just explain, you sort of hinted at new divides. Explain what those, so as you see it, what those divides
within,
are.
Within our societies, the sort of advanced economies, there are two divides that have opened up the last 40 years. One is spatial, and it's between booming agglomerations in Britain, London, and the southeast, and broken provincial cities. So that's one divide, a spatial divide. It's unusually stark in Britain, because in Britain it's shriveled to being a core periphery problem. London and the southeast, pretty well anywhere in it, is doing fine, and pretty well anywhere outside it is not doing as well. So that's a spatial rift. And the other is a new class rift defined on education. It's those with a good college education on top of which is then built skill, versus those who had less education but invested in manual skills, and those manual skills are becoming less valuable. And so part of society, the metropolitan skilled, are on an up escalator, and part of the society, the provincial manual skilled, are on a down escalator. And that's been going on for 40 years. But it's not been going on for 400 years. The 200 years until about 1980, both these processes were going in reverse. The spatial differences were narrowing, and the educational class differences were narrowing. And so the last 40 years is new, different, and vicious. As it happens, I straddle these things, right?
Yeah, I was about to say, explain for listeners the way in which there's a real personal element to the book.
Here I am, you know, if you want a metropolitan, highly educated elite, here I am, right?
Yeah.
But I didn't grow up like that. I grew up in Sheffield. If you want a broken city, Sheffield is actually emblematic of a broken city. A lot of people know, because a lot of people have seen the film, the wonderful moving film which describes it, The Full Monty.
Mm-hmm.
It's just most people who've seen The Full Monty forget that it's Sheffield, but it is. That was my relatives. Sheffield had been a steel town for 700 years. You know, there's a line in Chaucer, the knife came from Sheffield. And yet it was destroyed in about 5 years in the 1980s. At a huge emotional cost. And I saw that, I lived that. And then the education divide. As I say, I'm educationally quite fancy now, but both
my professor at Oxford is, it's not bad on that front.
But both my parents left school when they were 12 years old. I was first generation any education at all. And so I've straddled both of these divides. And indeed, the book opens with a little photograph of myself and my cousin, aged 4. We were born on the same day. And initially, we had very similar lives. And for reasons of chance and circumstance, they started to diverge. And then they just kept diverging big time because there were no buffers that corrected for that. Just as there were no buffers for the larger educational divide, and there were no buffers for the spatial divide. And yet there are loads of practical policies which could heal those divides. It's just that we didn't do it. For 40 years, the metropolitan elite that ran the country just didn't bother. They peeled off into a separate identity. They exited shared identity with everybody else. And in the process, they exited that sense of obligation to others.
And I mean, the book's got a very kind of economic-y title, The Future of Capitalism, but it's really a broad, I mean, as you're implying here, it's a broader argument than just narrow economics, isn't it? I mean, you're talking about sort of nationhood and family and these other...
Yeah, so there are three big organisations which determine our lives. There are family... That's the vital organisation for bringing up the young and caring for the old. Right? And when the state tries to replace the family, it generally makes an awful mess of it in those domains. Right? So alongside the family, there's the firm. We all work for business organisations, whether public or private, and the corporation is an entity that's been going for 2,000 years, and until the last 50, corporations were defined by a sense of purpose. But over the last 50 years, that's been completely revolutionised, with Milton Friedman saying the sole purpose of a firm is to make profit for its shareholders. So families have been have lost their centrality in the modern ideological narrative. It's all become the individual and the state. And the same is true of firms. They're just there to make a profit now. But actually, both firms and families and ordinary individual people are naturally moral actors. We naturally designed to bear responsibility. This is where it's not that I cease to be an economist, it's that I think economics has taken a very much too narrow a view of what a human being is, what a person is. Economics came up with this Mickey Mouse creature economic man whose sole concern was consumption. That was fantastically handy for utilitarians, but it's a complete travesty. So one of the areas I read into is neurology, social psychology, and I work with people in those disciplines. And they can't believe that economics has bought into this travesty of what a person is. Hardwired into us, alongside that hardwiring of consumerism. If we didn't want to consume, we'd die out, we'd be dead, because we wouldn't have had an urge to feed ourselves. So that's there. But alongside that, hardwired is a need to belong to a group. Because the people who didn't feel a need to belong to a group died out over the 400,000 years of human evolution. And similarly, once you feel you belong to a group, we're hardwired to want the esteem of the group. For the same reason, the people who didn't want the esteem of the group were so untrustworthy that they got thrown out of it and died out. So We've got three hardwired urges, one of which is consumption, but two of which are social, belong to a group and get the esteem of the group. That's in the brain. But we're not just brains, we're minds. And minds are built out of those hardwired drives of the brain, but minds are built socially by the ideas that circulate in a group. And so first and foremost, we are social animals. The primary unit of economic analysis needs to shift from this autonomous individual to a sense of the group.
This book, you don't, it's not a word you use a lot in it, but it struck me as a deeply conservative book with a small c, in the sense that you talk about social, the pillars of a society being the family and group identity, in a, whether that's a nation or whatever. Do you accept that characterization, or...?
I mean, George Akerlof describes it as the most revolutionary work in social science since Keynes, right? So if it's revolutionary, it's not conservative, right? It's about reciprocal obligations, building reciprocal obligations. And so if you mean by conservative, it's moving away from the idea that the only thing that matters is the individual and personal achievement of the individual. If you want to call it conservative to move away from that, then so be it. But you could equally well call it pretty radical to move away from that. The philosophy of reciprocal obligations is not well identified on a left-right spectrum at all. The birth of reciprocal obligations in amongst families coming together to do things was there was the cooperative movement. That's the practical political expression of reciprocal obligations across large groups of families. And the cooperative movement is conventionally thought of as being on the left. But similarly, business philanthropy is all about reciprocal obligations between a business and its workforce, a business and its local community, and business is usually thought of as somewhere on the right. So I think this trying to force my ideas onto a left-right spectrum fundamentally doesn't work. Certainly the book has attracted a lot of attention from politicians, and it's pretty equally balanced between politicians on the left and politicians on the right. So I don't like being pushed onto that spectrum. I don't belong on that spectrum. I have no political loyalties, allegiances, because I don't think the political lineup adequately characterizes the issues that really matter to us.
Let's talk then about you do describe a time when you thought capitalism was working better. And what are the big differences between then and now in terms of, not in terms of the consequences of the divides and so on, but, you know, what caused those consequences?
Well, I think the move in business away from a sense of purpose larger than profit to a sense of profit is the purpose was catastrophic. It doesn't even deliver good firm performance. So, and Britain is at the extreme end of corporations being driven by profit, because we're at the extreme end of boards being pinioned to fickle shareholders, because we're at the extreme end of dispersion of ownership amongst financial institutions that have no shared identity with the company, with its purpose at all. And if they don't like the quarterly profits, they just sell. Britain's very unusual. Until I did the book, I thought America was at the extreme end. Yep. But it isn't. Britain's at the extreme end. The best example of that is when Kraft, the big American conglomerate, wanted to move into chocolate. There were two big American chocolate firms that would naturally have gone for, Mars and Hershey. But knew it hadn't got a hope of getting them, because each of those companies had blocking family shareholdings, and the families had made their money. They didn't want an extra billion. What they wanted was a sense of future for the corporation that their family had built over the generations. They were immensely proud of that as part of their identity, and they wanted to keep building that company with a sense of purpose larger than profit. And so what did Kraft go for? It went for Cadbury. And Cadbury was the archetypical company that had been founded by a family with a sense of purpose larger than profit. Mm-hmm. Cadbury was the archetypical Quaker company, which had magnificent past. And Cadbury was destroyed. Because the city said, oh, you know, an extra 30 pence on the share price? Great, sell. And it's disappeared as a company of purpose.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
When I was reading your book, I was struck by a gap in some of your arguments and in, I think, British politics generally, which is that a lot of what you argue is not only... A lot of what you argue is sort of point, almost a point of consensus in Britain's political class. So you cannot, you know, every think tank has its answer to the question, what should we do about rebalancing the economy between North and South, for instance. John Lewis is held up as a great example of business by conservatives and Labour politicians. So, you know, quite a lot of people recognise this problem. Why is there, you know, there's this funny gap, isn't there, where we are talking about the right stuff in your as you'd have it, but we seem so hopeless at solving those problems.
Well, we're not doing anything about it. It's easy to talk. Actually, for most of the last 40 years, we didn't even talk about it, right? We've been in denial. So at last, we're talking about it. But neither side has moved on to practical, pragmatic remedies because they're both trapped in ideologies. And this is the big change from the past. I think all ideologies are dangerous because the truth is the world and any society is a sort of dynamic process which we can't predict with any degree of certainty, and the nature of the problems thrown up, the anxieties, keeps changing, and so each time we're faced with new anxieties in new situation, and we need to just work out the best thing that's likely to work in this context. That's what pragmatism is. It says, look at the context, try and work out what you can do best now. Don't think it'll work forever. Mm-hmm. Right? Ideology thinks there's a Bible. Mm-hmm. Right? This is true for all time. This is what we've got to do. And you see this both in the ideology of the right and the ideology of the left. And it's bloody dangerous. They try and fit the new anxieties into their old ideology when it comes to the solutions. And that won't work. Most of the book is not about, oh dear, there's the new anxieties. Mm. That's the first... sort of third of the book is, here are these new anxieties which have gone unaddressed for 40 years. The next two-thirds of the book is, here's what we can actually do about them, pragmatic solutions that would work for now.
Well, let's talk about those pragmatic solutions then. So what I mean, if you had sort of, you know, if you had a 10-minute meeting with Theresa May or whoever the next prime minister is, and you had, you know, rank in terms of importance, you know, the top proposals you'd have for that policymaker.
Yeah, sure. So, okay, so which should we start with? Let's do the class divide.
Mm-hmm.
And which is basically a challenge of not of transferring consumption to the people on the down escalator. That was sort of New Labour's fantasy, that all that mattered was consumption. That is a travesty of, again, of what a human being is. A human being is an actor and not a passive recipient of consumption, an actor who gets dignity from contributing. And so the challenge is to make the poorer half of society more productive so that they earn more and contribute more and have a stronger sense of self-esteem.
So just to sort of pin you down on that, at the margin, you would be pro policies that you would be willing to sacrifice, for example, you'd be willing to sacrifice GDP growth for an economy that gave people, you know, better, more satisfying jobs or stable jobs or something.
Of course.
I'm not asking that like you're a lunatic for thinking that. Yeah. I'm just you know, trying to clarify the trade-offs involved.
Of course. Well, there may not be a trade-off, but of course we should do it. Mm-hmm. Of course. GDP isn't the god, mm-hmm. right? GDP is one very crude measure of how satisfying are people's lives, right? Mm. And it's clearly, you know, a completely inadequate measure. So how do we raise the productivity of ordinary people? Well, we start very early because we start basically when the kid is born. Because if things go wrong in childhood and in teenagehood, by the time the kid drops into the labour market, they're not very productive and there's not much that can be done. So we start, this is the concept of social maternalism. Hmm. We get rid of social paternalism, which has been a disaster. Social paternalism is the state will tell you what to do. The state will take on the obligations, it will strip obligations from firms and families, and it will just tell people what to do. Right? It will boss families around, it will regulate firms, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. This has proved disastrous. So all the way along the line, from birth, so for example, preschool. Britain's preschool stuff is still a mess. There's a model out there which works very, very well, and that's France. They're called École Maternelle. Right? Everybody goes to free schools, run for 2.5 to 5, and they work very well. One of our kids was in them. Brilliant. Right? Was in one of the poorest towns in France. It was very good, and it was run by the state, financed by the state, out of taxation. Because everybody went there, the poorest households also went there. So the children who need it most are part of it. We're not doing that. Our system is complex, expensive, and doesn't work very well. Once children go to school, they need, especially the people who don't have a good social network of contacts, they need mentors. And mentors don't mean people bossing them around. They mean mentors. Right? Similarly, then the teachers need a lot of autonomy in order to do a good job. We've stripped people in their jobs of autonomy over the last 25 years. The role model there for autonomy at teachers is Finland. And Finland regularly comes top or second in the world educational rankings. It's right up there with Singapore. And the principle in Finland is empowered teachers. Right? Trust teachers. Don't boss them about. We've gone the opposite direction. Total tick box. So that's social maternalism. And then when the child finally comes out of school, what you then need is massive efforts in vocational training. And Britain has basically dismantled its vocational training. At the same time, it's puffed up with overexpanded universities. And we've got this ludicrous juxtaposition. We've got 3 of the top 10 universities in the world, which is great for the cognitively most gifted and completely useless for the 60% of the population that shouldn't actually be at university, right? Should be doing the non-cognitive route for skill. And there the role models, a good role model is Switzerland. 60% of the Swiss population goes into vocational training route. It's very prestigious. You can become chief executive of a Swiss bank through that route. Switzerland also has a top 10 university, so you can have the two together. You don't have to sacrifice the universities in order to do it. But vocational training in Switzerland is a four-year course. It's paid. It's prestigious. And it's run half of the costs are contributed by firms who therefore get very involved and make damn sure that when people come out, they're employable in those firms. So that's healing the educational divide. Then we've got the spatial divide. And the spatial divide is just the same. It's not put the north of England on Benefit Street. It's that the provincial cities need, and it's not even bring back the old industries. That's the sort of Trump fantasy.
Yeah.
But you do need knowledge clusters in all the major cities. And that's entirely feasible, but it's a coordination problem. A new knowledge firm wants to be with a cluster with other new knowledge firms. And if there's no coordination, the safest place to be is just the biggest city. And so we have no coordination in Britain. And so the biggest city is always London. The answer is always London. Go to London. You can do things about that. Public policy can build new clusters in provincial cities. Not everywhere, but every region needs a city with a knowledge cluster, with a sense of the stuff is happening here. There is a future here if you're skilled, young, bright. And that has to be built. Now, it costs money.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
And you get it by taxing the big agglomeration. The tragedy of Britain is that our metropolitan elite has actually come to believe that it deserves what it's earning. And it doesn't. There's a very simple reason for that, is that agglomerations generate huge economic rents of agglomeration, which makes all the skilled people in that agglomeration more productive just by virtue of being together. So they're all super productive. They think I'm earning and super productive because I have my wonderful personal skill. And that's rubbish. You transfer them from London to Stoke and they wouldn't be as productive. Who should capture those economic rents of agglomeration? All of us, because we've all put in the investment over the past couple of centuries, investment in infrastructure and in the regulatory, the law, the framework of a functioning democracy with the rule of law, all of these things that make London such a great place to be. Who actually gets the rents for agglomeration? The landowners in London, the property owners in London, and the highly skilled in London. And so, sorry, but you need to be taxed, right? Some of that productivity you deserve, some of it the whole nation deserves.
And what sort of tax is that? I mean, we're looking at sort of property taxes and wealth taxes rather than as much.
No, we're looking at at taxes on land. It's extraordinary that the appreciation in urban land values in London has gone so lightly taxed. Taxes on the appreciation of property values, same thing applies. Extraordinary how little of that's been captured by the state and redistributed. And taxes on the earnings of the highly skilled. And the tax rates need to be higher in London than in provincial cities. Right? So that's a package. London is the new oil, if you like. And it's a very appropriate analogy, because what was oil? It was economic rents. Mm-hmm. We captured the economic rents on oil. We've not captured the economic rents on London.
If there's one thing that, both on the geographical point and the class point, one thing that I think your argument stands out for and would put off some people on the left and for different reasons put off some people on the right, is you are, to take the left point first, inequality is not, in sort of strict economic terms, is not something that crops up as much as you might expect in this book. You have a sort of your own understanding of fairness, which is about kind of desert, and it's not simply a question of differences in incomes between here
it's
and there.
It's equality of dignity, and as you say, it's respect for desert. The fact that people, if they've contributed, feel that they deserve something back, and so we should indeed recognise desert as a criterion in taxation. You're quite right, I get pushback from the ideologues on the left and the ideologues on the right. I'm very proud that overall, Future of Capitalism has been amazingly well received. New York Times book of this and the Financial Times and so on. So that's why you're here. But
late to the party.
I have united Dominic Lawson on the right and Paul Mason on the left in both hating it. And I think I'm really proud of that.
Well, beyond the policy proposals that you detailed some of the stuff just there, it seems to me, as much as anything, this is also a book about a change of mindset among not just policymakers, but the sort of the winners of the story you're telling.
Yeah.
So explain, if you would sort of had a room full of bankers and lawyers in London and you had 5 minutes with them, what are you trying to get into their heads that they don't that you think they don't understand at the moment?
Yeah, I speak regularly to roomfuls of such people. So,
yeah, yeah.
And they're human beings too. They're not just driven by greed and profit. And so I don't get much pushback from them, to be honest.
Yep.
They're not the ideologues, right? The business community is, most of the business community fully recognizes they need a sense of purpose. Purpose beyond profit. A corporation, a firm, is defined by its purpose. Of course, it's got to be profitable, otherwise it wouldn't be sustainable or scalable. That's part of the genius of the capitalist system, right? But I'm not getting pushback from business. I'm just not. And the message that the metropolitan successful peeled off from shared identity, and that has provoked mutinies from the people who feel abandoned, that's widely recognised now. The diagnosis is really very seldom challenged, right? Some of the proposed solutions, some people find a bit painful, and that's fair enough. And the solution is, I'm a pragmatist, so I'm not saying you've got to do all these things to the letter. Therefore, a debate, adjustment, learn as you go. Indeed, the book is very careful to say we should feel our way with these policies. Try them a little bit at a time, see how they work and error correct. Right? So it's not an ideological set of solutions, it's a pragmatic analysis.
And is that a lesson you learned from the developing world? Do you think that's applying those development economic skills to...
My God, if anywhere's suffered from ideological solutions, it's the developing world. Of course, pragmatism is essential. Pragmatism and a sense of modesty in trying proposals out, recognising that at best they're only provisional and they have to be error-corrected through a process of experience.
Paul Collier, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Paul Collier on the future of capitalism. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free.
That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.